حديث سال الذي صبا يذوب بكم وينضحك وفي طلب الرضا منكم له الغايات تتفق أن العبد الفقير أنا غرامي أنتم على ما
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. And we're talking about ubudiyya. Now, in continuation to this idea that we must never feel like our spiritual movement is enough, we should never suffice at any station of a spiritual ubudiyya, of spiritual servitude to Allah, and we should always be continuously moving forward. Because none of these spiritual stations is worthy of our true value in the eyes of Allah. Now, one of the very special and secret things that we can do, or one of the secrets that we can do, which is very, very effectful in increasing, enhancing, and powering up our ubudiyya, our servitude to, and our obedience to Allah, is the salah, or as is called in Persian, the namaz. Or let's call it in English, these five daily prayers, obligatory prayers, wajib prayers that we conduct. It's interesting, we sometimes think that the salah is such a simple thing, it is such a regular thing, it is such a constant thing. But it's interesting, all of the spiritual wayfarers and all of the spiritual masters and all of the great Urafa, the Islamic Gnostics, these spiritual, amazing individuals that have passed in our history and are currently alive as well. They have said that one of the main keys to ubudiyya is this very salah. As one of these great Urafa by the name of Imam Khomeini, he says, none of the acts of worship and obedience can be on the same footing as that of the salah, which is a comprehensive, jami', ma'ajun, a divine mixture which undertakes the happiness of humanity. And if it is accepted, dear brothers and sisters, all other acts of worship will also be accepted, as it is related in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so we are to exert the utmost seriousness in obtaining the acceptance of this salah. And of course, we pray to Almighty Allah to accept this salah from us. Because of course, as we said, no station is sufficient. So we should always be trying to improve our salah in one way or the other. Finally, we should never feel tired in this quest. And if we do feel tired, of course, because sometimes you do feel tired, consider that being tired to be a blessing from Allah, that you are tiring yourselves not in order to acquire a dollar or a pound or a penny or a quarter or a lira or a real. You are tiring yourself in order to gain the satisfaction of Allah. You are tiring yourself in your quest towards perfection, and your perfection is the acceptance and the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah. Exalted and glorified is He. So continue on your path towards the perfection of ubudiyya, and remember that a key component of this perfection of our ubudiyya is the salah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Sign up. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we will listen to Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. There's a very interesting verse in Surah Taha. It's ayah number 14, and it says بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إنني أنا الله لا إله إلا أنا فَعْبُدْنِي وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ لِذِكْرِي. There are many lessons that we can learn from this verse. The first is the testimony of faith, the shahada of La ilaha illallah. The foundation of Islam is monotheism, in believing in the oneness and uniqueness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's absolutely no Muslim that does not know how significantly important believing in one God is. Of course, much can be said about this and the Quran and also the Sunnah of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, are full of lessons and reminders, verses and hadiths that speak about Tawheed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made sure that the first thing that prophets, peace be upon them, instructed those around them, their followers, was believing in one God. Now, when it comes to monotheism, why is it in this particular ayah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala starts off in this sequence? إِنَّنِي أَنَا اللَّهِ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا أَنَا. I am God, there is no deity other than me. فَعْبُدْنِي, so worship me. And then the third part of this ayah, Allah says, وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ لِذِكْرِي, and uphold prayers for my sake.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
There is consensus at the highest political and military levels in the West that closing Ukraine's airspace to Russia would likely trigger World War III and potentially result in a catastrophic nuclear war. Despite this, many EU legislators suggest it's time for NATO to become directly involved in the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Unfortunately, our good friends from Washington, they were too afraid. They were afraid that they are triggering the war. But I can't imagine where we're going to trigger the war. Europe is in the war already.
But a debate on the subject in the European Parliament on Thursday heard calls for peace rather than further intervention.
I don't think this war can be won militarily from one side, and therefore it is essential that we do all we can to ensure there is a ceasefire.
According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue. That's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian defense minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist. He explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticized for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonized. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corey from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corey became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corey, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corey's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things the Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corey acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Pereza, London.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military cooperation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the noose on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
A drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now.
Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
cut away the gigantic mountain to get to your love. It was an impossible condition set by the 6th century Iranian king Khosrow to dissuade Farhad from marrying Shirin, his love. But the enchanted lover accepted the daring offer and used his sculpting axe to dig through Mount Bisotun. But halfway through, Farhad heard the sad news that King Khosrow had already married Shirin. This tragic love story still echoes in the Iranian city of Kermanshah and Mount Bisotun, which is now hosting visitors from across Iran to celebrate the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz. Bisotun is just one of many historical sites in Iran's western province of Kermanshah. Anahita Temple is equally significant. The historical monument was constructed back in the 4th century BC to honor the goddess of water, Anahita. And in the heart of Kermanshah lies this amazing stone arch called Tagh-e-Bostan, which dates back to some 2,400 years ago. What made it even more attractive is music performances by local ensembles who sing and play the tambour instrument, to ring in Nowruz.
Happy Nowruz to all Iranians. Today our group played the tambour, an old Iranian instrument that is 8,000 years old. We hosted music bands from other parts of Iran and enjoyed their performances.
Kermanshah was the second stop for the caravan of Nowruz, comprising cultural activists from across Iran, who took part to welcome the Persian New Year, due on March 21st. The caravan set out from Hamadan, got here in Kermanshah, and will move on to Sanandaj, all to display Iran's cultural diversity. That's the result of peaceful coexistence of many ethnicities in the country.
Nowruz is celebrated by over 300 million people worldwide, with each nation having its own unique style in marking the occasion. Now, these people say Nowruz is a time to celebrate these differences, as they make the ancient festivity one of the most ethnically diverse cultural events in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kermanshah.
An emergency meeting of NATO defence ministers concluded at the military alliance's headquarters in Brussels on Wednesday. They are ready to defend NATO countries in the event Russia expands its mission beyond Ukraine, it's claimed.
There are now hundreds of thousands of forces at heightened alert across the alliance. 100,000 US troops in Europe.
A number of analysts have asked the question, how would Washington feel if Russia positioned 100,000 of its troops, for example, in Mexico? NATO military commanders have been ordered to examine how there can be even further expansion with respect to land, sea, air, cyber, and space capabilities. Jens Stoltenberg has called on NATO members to spend at least 2% of their GDP to grow military forces in response to Russia. Western powers say they won't get directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, but will continue to spend billions on arming Ukraine.
Certainly, we support their ability to defend themselves, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
Unprecedented sanctions against Moscow are starting to hit the EU's economy hard as fuel prices continue to rise and the cost of living generally goes up.
Those are substantial costs that that will have to be paid by the EU collectively, but of course they will hit certain countries harder.
Sanctions are not the answer when it comes to dealing with Russia, according to some experts.
It's not a good situation because it seems to me there are a few mistakes. First of all, such kind of sanctions will be counterproductive generally. It's a way to confrontation.
As the war rages on, Joe Biden and other NATO leaders are due to hold a summit in the Belgian capital on Thursday of next week to consider further options. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Mid Shaban is one of Muslims' great Eids, marking the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam. Afghans gathered here at Sakhi Shrine in Kabul to pay tribute to their last Imam and celebrate the occasion.
I congratulate Afghans and other Muslims on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi. This is a joyous Eid for us and we have come here to celebrate it. Prophet Muhammad has promised the advent of Mahdi, and we are eagerly waiting for that day. May he come and fill the world with justice and peace.
Fortunately, here everything looks great. People are happy celebrating Mid Shaban. As an Afghan, I mark the birth anniversary of Mid Shaban every year, but today it's different. More families have come here since the security threats are gone.
Kabul residents decorate the Sakhi Shrine and hold traditional ceremonies, announcing their allegiance to Imam Mahdi. They also take the occasion as a chance for highlighting Islamic solidarity among Muslims. At the same time, the Taliban say they will tighten the security during the Eid.
God willing, we have tightened security everywhere. We are serving all people of Afghanistan and don't let anything or anyone threaten them. Today, people can mark their occasions without trouble.
People in Afghanistan have been struggling with poverty and hunger crisis. In the meantime, they don't miss any chance to mark cultural occasions and to spread Islamic bliss. People have come here for the love of their last Imam, Hazrat Mahdi. They observe Mid Shaban as a great Eid and hold such ceremonies every year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A coalition of truckers, farmers, fishermen, and public contractors are blocking refineries as oil prices in France have hit an all-time high, surpassing 2 euros per liter. Added to higher costs at the pump is inflation in prices of food and general goods, as well as looming shortages of vital industrial commodities. France could be headed for a spring of economic discontent amid a presidential election.
Début 2021, le prix du brut était à $51 le baril.
At the start of 2021, the price of gas was at $50 a barrel. First, we had the demand shock caused by the end of coronavirus lockdowns. And then we had a supply shock caused by the failure to meet that demand shock. And now we have the unrest in Ukraine, shocking not just the oil market, but seemingly every market. It's been quite a roller coaster.
Last week, the European Union decided against sanctioning Russian fossil fuels, which would have provoked catastrophic economic consequences. However, France has just announced plans to end Russian gas and oil imports in just 5 years. They also announced a package of measures designed to protect French businesses and consumers from rampant inflation, but there's not much they can do about the actual price of oil.
Absolument pas. Non, la dynamique de l'OPEP.
The French government can do absolutely nothing about this situation. It's Russia and Saudi Arabia which have decided the price of oil in recent years, and it's according to their financial and budgetary needs. These two used to care about not making the Americans angry over high prices, but no one really knows how current geopolitical changes will develop. What's certain is that France and Europe have no control over oil prices.
The government recently announced a rebate of 15 cents per liter on all gasoline from April 1st until August 1st, but they didn't do one thing in their power: reduce gasoline taxes.
In France, two-thirds of the price of gas comes from taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the lower classes more than the rich. In 2018, the Yellow Vest movement was sparked by an increase in gas taxes.
Gas prices back then were just €1.50 per liter, illustrating how precarious the situation is for the average Frenchman and perhaps for politicians facing re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the cost of living in the EU goes through the roof, union members held a demonstration outside a meeting of EU finance ministers in Brussels on Tuesday. They want the bloc's leaders to provide more support for EU citizens who are being hit hard by the financial ramifications resulting from the conflict in Ukraine.
And it's also why we need to say that we need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation, and now we have to say stop this war and stop Putin in Ukraine.
Finance ministers have signed off on the fourth package of sanctions against Russia. 600 individuals have been targeted and Russian exports too. However, there is a very negative boomerang effect for the EU itself.
We'll see overall higher inflation, pressure on energy and food prices and market volatility. Rising energy and commodity prices, disruptions of supply chains, it all will have negative knock-off effect on consumer prices and on investment.
Russia, which is now the most sanctioned country in the world, has been removed from the so-called Most Favoured Nation clause relating to the World Trade Organization.
This major decision entitles the EU to increase customs duties at any moment on Russian products. As regards sanctions, all options remain on the table.
Finance ministers say 200 billion euro worth of loans are available to EU nations most impacted by the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Critics say if Western leaders had have shown more skill and compromise when listening to Russia's security concerns, the misery now being piled on Ukrainian citizens and the financial hardship being placed on EU citizens could have been avoided. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the Ukraine exodus intensifies, Poland's major cities are starting to show signs of strain under the pressure, with local authorities warning that they simply can't cope with more arrivals.
This is just one of the many border crossings between Poland and Ukraine. Just behind me, a few meters, is Ukraine. Now, all day long, we've been witnessing coaches, vans, cars going backwards and forwards, supplies and aid going in, people and refugees coming out.
Whilst here, we managed to speak with Max, a Ukrainian from the Czech Republic. He's been waiting hours for his mother-in-law, who has fled from Kyiv. Speaking to Press TV, he informed us about his anger at the lack of help he sees on the ground from the rest of Europe.
I have no words how to describe overall situation. It's horrible. When people just crossing by in winter with kids, I have no words how to describe this situation. Frankly, there is support from Europe, but perhaps not quite enough.
Then suddenly, a call came through. Alex's mother-in-law had finally arrived.
I'm glad that we have finally succeeded.
Reunited again, finally. They now can head off to safety. But many more refugees aren't so lucky and remain stranded without key essentials. With reports of at least two Ukrainians crossing the Polish border every 3 seconds, how long can Poland maintain this huge humanitarian effort? Robert Carter, Dorohusk.
Iran expects a good agreement to be reached in the near future in its talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. This was made by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian at a press conference following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. Amir Abdollahian said the delay in the negotiations could lead to the creation of good ground for resolving the remaining issues. He also said that Russia has not created any obstacles in the negotiations on the JCPOA revival, and that the Vienna talks are in no way connected with the conflict in Ukraine.
Russia does not create any obstacles to reaching agreements. There is no connection between the developments in Ukraine and the Vienna talks. And until the end of the negotiations and the achievement of a good, powerful and lasting agreement, Russia will be close to Iran and will support Iran to achieve this agreement.
Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said his country has received written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions on Russia over Ukraine will not affect cooperation with Iran within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdullahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767. Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The variants' rapid spread, different vaccine strategies, and varying levels of immunity worldwide make the pandemic's future difficult to model, says David Adam, writer, in an article published under the heading, "Will Omicron End the Pandemic?" Here's what experts say. Stay tuned for more. On January 11th, just 7 weeks after the Omicron variant was first reported, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned of a tidal wave of infection washing from west to east across the world. 50 of the 53 countries in Europe and Central Asia had reported cases of Omicron, said Hans-Henry Kluge, the WHO's regional director for Europe. Countries would have to cope as best they could, he said, guided by their individual epidemiological situation, available resources, vaccination uptake status, and socioeconomic context. In recent weeks, countries in Europe and the United States have felt the full force of Omicron wave. In the UK, which has reported most infections, daily COVID-19 cases peaked at more than 160,000 earlier this month. Scientists there say all nations are facing the same major problem, the sheer speed at which the variant spreads. And although the WHO and others have suggested that huge numbers of Omicron infections could signal the end of the pandemic because of the short-term surge in immunity that will follow, researchers warn that the situation remains volatile and difficult to model. It moves so fast that it gives very little time to prepare any kind of response, so decisions have to be made under huge uncertainty, says Graham Medley, an infectious diseases modeler at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who advises the UK government. Numbers of Omicron infections can double in less than 2 days, which is significantly faster than previous SARS-CoV-2 variants and closer to what public health officials would expect from the milder influenza virus. One scientist says Omicron is flu on acid. We haven't seen that speed before, and it meant you couldn't vax your way out of it, adds Christina Pagel, a healthcare data analyst at University College London, adding, even if you could vax everybody, it still takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to kick in, and by then you are in the middle of it. That places policymakers and researchers who advise them in an unenviable position. It was a situation where you either put it in restrictions very, very early or you do nothing, Pagel says, adding, but if you wait to see what happens, then it's too late. Along with other countries, Britain tightened regulations in December, but it was a controversial move, particularly because reports from South Africa, which was hit by Omicron the previous month, suggested that the variant seemed to cause less severe illness and hospitalization, a conclusion now supported by the experience of the UK and other places. UK modelers were initially torn about how to use information from South Africa. It's relatively straightforward to update a computer model to account for changes in the biological properties of a new variant. However, as the pandemic has progressed, it has become much harder to simulate the baseline immune response of a country's population and so to judge how that will limit spread. In the early days of the pandemic, researchers could assume that most people worldwide were equally susceptible to infection because COVID-19 was a new disease and no vaccines were available. But 12 months of different vaccine strategies, types, and take-up rates from country to country, as well as fluctuating rates of infection and recovery, have left a diverse immunological landscape. The probability that infection will put someone in hospital is absolutely a key parameter. But we are now estimating that in an obviously not naive population, says Mark Woolhouse, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Edinburgh, UK, who also advises the government, adding, when you are making those sorts of estimates, formally you really should remake them for every population you're interested in, and that applies everywhere. Modelers were confounded by the lack of specifics in South African data about reduced severity. There was no quantitative analysis, Woolhouse says, adding, so what numbers do you plug in? Are you saying 10% less pathogenic, or 50% less, or 90% less? Still speaking in a personal capacity, Woolhouse says that some influential modelers in the UK were wrong not to allow for any reduced severity, instead working with assumed hospitalization rates for Omicron that were identical to those of previous variants. That's clearly a pessimistic assumption, he says, adding, I do not think it could have been much clearer from the beginning that there was this possibility it was less pathogenic, and you know, being crystal clear on what the policy implications of that difference might be. The heterogeneity in immunological baselines and other important factors such as population dynamics from country to country make it difficult to predict international spread of Omicron with any precision or to assess, for example, how the variant might take hold in countries with lower vaccination rates. It's very hard to answer that question, says Julian Tang, a consultant virologist at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, UK. And it's not very useful because if you say it's spreading in pattern X, Y, Z across Western Europe and then A, B, C across North America and M and O in Africa, that doesn't really help anybody. The waning protection against infection that vaccines offer against Omicron also complicates the picture. Lab studies have indicated that inactivated virus vaccines, which make up almost half of the 10 billion doses distributed worldwide, elicit few antibodies against the variant. Does that mean that Omicron will rip through places that rely on these shots even faster? Not necessarily, says Woolhouse. The inactivated virus vaccines might induce a broader immunity that would react to a wider range of strains because it will elicit immune responses against viral proteins other than spike, which is particularly variable, he says. It's a very interesting question, but I simply haven't seen a formal analysis of it yet. That's because there are few real-world data to go on. It's only just hitting countries that have used them, says Pagel. Among the countries that rely on inactivated virus vaccines, Omicron seems to be making the most headway in the Philippines, which saw an exponential rise in COVID-19 cases this month, particularly in Manila. The number of new infections in the capital does not seem to be dropping, but the virus is spreading farther afield. Definitely cases are slowing down in the national capital region, but in other regions it is now increasing, said Maria Rosario Veregui, health spokesperson for the Philippines government. Vaccination rates are still relatively low in the Philippines, with 53% of the population fully vaccinated. Officials dare say they want to vaccinate all the country's 77 million adults by May. Although vaccines are likely to continue protecting against severe symptoms, Pagel says, infection will continue to spread, adding, I think the assumption is that none of the vaccines are going to give you long-lasting protection against infection. Tang agrees, saying, I don't think vaccines are the way this pandemic is going to end. So how will it end? Not with Omicron, researchers predict. This will not be the last variant, and so the next variant will have its own characteristics, Medley says. Given that the virus is unlikely to disappear completely, COVID-19 will inevitably become an endemic disease, scientists say. But that's a slippery concept, and one that means different things to different people. I think it's the expectation that the general behavior is somehow towards the situation where we have so much immunity in the population that we would no longer see very deadly epidemics, says Sebastian Funk, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The transition to endemicity, or living with the virus without restrictions and safeguards, is difficult to model with any accuracy, he adds. That's partly because even the best disease models struggle to make sensible forecasts beyond a few weeks ahead. It's also because endemicity reflects a judgment call on how many deaths societies are willing to tolerate, while the global population steadily builds up immunity. For Woolhouse, COVID-19 will truly become endemic only when more adults are protected against severe infection because they have been exposed multiple times to the virus as children and so have developed natural immunity. That will take decades, and it means many older people today who were not exposed as children will remain vulnerable and might need continued vaccinations. That strategy has its flaws. Some of those exposed as children will develop long COVID, and it relies on children continuing to show much lower rates of severe illness as variants evolve. There are no guarantees that the next variant will be milder, but Tang says that seems to be the pattern so far. He says this virus is getting milder and milder with each iteration.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. This is The Lantern, and thank you very much for joining us on this brand new episode of the show, coming to you not live from the studios of IRIB English Radio. I am so for the expression that says life or happiness or whatever is what you make of it, or that it's based on your perspective. I'm so for that. I agree with that. 95%. The other 5% that's left is, you know, for special occasions where your perspective is sort of altered or mutilated due to, I don't know, internal or external elements or variants. But most of the times I found that everything in life is what I make of it. And it's very much based on my perspective, my perception of what the world is or should be, how life is or should be, what are my expectations of life, of myself, of others, all of it. It depends on me. And, you know, once you develop that, you feel so liberated because then you're not relying on anything or anyone almost. To make you happy or to satisfy you. Well, you know what time it is. Let's listen to a short story and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear friend, salam. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. Today we have a new story. Let's see what's our story for today. Happiness is based on your perspective. I read about these two men who'd been bricklayers for more than 30 years. They were looking on a huge skyscraper downtown. One man was always negative, discouraged, constantly complaining, and dreaded going to work. The other man was just the opposite. He was excited to show up each day and had an attitude of faith and enthusiasm about life. One day a friend came by the job site and asked them separately what they were doing. The first said, "We're just laying brick. We've been doing this for 30 years. It's so boring. One brick on top of the other." Then the friend asked the second bricklayers. He just lit up. "Why, we're building a magnificent skyscraper," he said. "This structure will stand tall for generations to come. I'm just so excited that I could be a part of it." Each bricklayer's happiness or lack of it was based on his perspective. You can be laying brick or you can be building a beautiful skyscraper. The choice is up to you. You can go to work each day and just punch in on the clock and dread doing there and do as little as possible. Or you can show up with enthusiasm and give it your best, knowing that you're making the world a better place. From the book, Every Day a Friday.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
We are not definitely, most of the episodes of this show, like 99% of them, probably don't apply to those who are suffering from mental illnesses. I don't know, depression or anxiety disorder or bipolar disorder or borderline personality disorder or schizophrenia or any disorder at all, because I firmly believe that you cannot apply a lot of life's general rules to those individuals, because it's like, you know, you can't apply the same set of trainings to a healthy person who wants to train or prepare for a marathon and a handicapped person. You know, they require totally different kinds of training and they require totally different kinds of practice and method and approach and yada, yada, yada. So that just applies to mental health as well. And that's not the topic of our conversation at all. But, you know, sometimes in very rare occasions, even for mental health, for depression, for anxiety, a little change in perspective can help. Definitely. Doesn't cure, doesn't heal, doesn't treat, but it helps. You know, it at least helps you cope better, or it helps you find hope that things can turn around for the better. But the world is definitely just how we choose to see it. You know, if we choose to see the world as this dark, broken, dysfunctional, oppressive, corrupt, disgusting, filthy with sedition and lechery and hypocrisy sort of place, then oof, you know, who'd want to live here? It's awful. It's absolutely awful. And it wouldn't be incorrect either, because the world really is like that, isn't it? I'm not even going to say especially through these last few decades. No, it's always been like this. I mean, there was a time that the population of Earth was like 4 or 5 people, and there was still murder and there was still corruption, let alone now that it's like billions and billions times more. It has billions and billions of times more population. Naturally, the oppression would multiply as well. But here's the thing. Here's the rule that I learned maybe when I was a teen. And then I felt that it helped my viewpoint toward life in a lot of situations. I don't even remember where I heard or read this, but I'm sure you guys have heard it as well. It says that if one day you leave your house with the intention of finding a red car, right? And you're going to go on the street and all of a sudden all you see is red cars because your mind, you have sent that command to your mind that this is what we're going to focus on, right? Your consciousness has commanded your mind to focus on red cars, and then your mind has sent that command to your eyes, and you know how the system works. And then that is all you're going to be able to notice that day. All the red cars. Or like if you lose your spouse or your friend or your child in a crowd and you think to yourself, oh, they were wearing a yellow jacket. And then you go into the crowd, all of a sudden you're like, wow, there's a lot of yellow jackets. And you keep mistaking that random, those 52 yellow jackets for, you know, the person you're looking for. I totally butchered that. I butchered that life lesson. But the point is, whatever you focus on, that's what you're going to find. Okay? If you focus your mind, if I focus my mind, my energy, my thoughts on negative things, like literally, that is all I am going to notice. If I focus it on the positive things, that's all I'm going to notice. The funny thing is, those two things are going to be there no matter what, side by side, living together, simultaneously, minding their own business, not giving a rat's whisker whether I notice them or not. It is me. I choose which one I'm going to notice, which one I'm going to highlight, and which one I'm going to put on the pedestal of my mind and create for it a gravitational force that constantly pulls my mind, my emotions, my energy, and my time toward it. The choice is totally up to me, always, 95% of the time. Oh, sometimes we're programmed, taught, we've been cultured, traditionalized to notice certain things, and we have to, if it's a negative thing, then we have to go through the process of unlearning it. And I'll tell you, that's not easy, but it is necessary if we wish to develop a more wholesome, meaningful, I'm not necessarily saying enjoyable, but peaceful relationship with life. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.